she mused. I am also the craftsman wielding the tool. I am carving away at myself. There was talk in Brixton of a place called the Terminal Ward. It had always sounded ominous to Dolores, but when she and Marion were finally moved there, it seemed positively luxurious. Now, rather than live in separate cells, the sisters could be in the same room. There was even a private toilet next to the room, so that when they needed to urinate, because all they produced at this point was urine, they no longer had to rely on a chamber pot. Getting nearer to paradise by the minute, Dolores joked. There was a mirror in the cell, and she would stare at herself, her long nightdress hanging from her skeletal frame, and imagine that she looked like the ghost of some former inmate haunting the wing. By this point, in the assessments of one of the doctors treating them, the Price sisters were living entirely off their own bodies. They had become so weak that even walking across the room could leave Dolores fatigued, her heart thumping in her ribcage like a drum. They could not sit or lie in any one position for long, or they would get bed sores from their bones pressing against their skin. To alleviate this, their beds were fitted with ripple mattresses that had a thin cushion of circulating air. Each day passes and we fade a little more, Dolores wrote to her mother. The sisters lay side by side in their beds, with three prison officers on constant guard. Dolores worried about Marion, worried that she was more anxious to die, more ready to accept it. Sometimes Dolores would be talking to her, reminiscing or gossiping, a valiant facsimile of their old animated chatter. And she would look across and see Marion, dreadfully pale and thin, her eyes closed, her lips parted, her fingers long and spindly from starvation. The sight of her sister frightened Dolores, and she would say, "Marion, wake up. Don't go first," she would think. "Don't go first." The likelihood that the sisters may end their lives must now clearly be envisioned, Jenkins warned in early June. He had considered going to see the Prices, hoping perhaps that he might be able to dissuade them from dying. But he decided against it, on the grounds that, as the person charged with deciding their fate, he had a duty to stand back a little and be dispassionate. Albert Price, after a visit to his daughters in the terminal ward, emerged and told the press that they were ready to meet their fate. "They are happy," he said, "happy about dying." The provisionals braced for violence, warning that if the sisters died, the consequences for the British government will be devastating. Reports in the press claimed that a priest had visited the sisters and administered the last rites. In a letter to a friend, Dolores wrote, "Well, please give our love to our family and all our friends." She concluded, "We are ready for what is ahead." Then Britain blinked. On the 3rd of June, another Irish hunger striker, Michael Gaughan, died in Parkhurst Prison on the Isle of Wight. Gaughan was also an IRA volunteer, though he had played no role in the bombing mission. He was imprisoned for robbing a bank in London, and when he went on hunger strike, Dolores Price had been annoyed. She'd been striking since November when he started in April, and she felt that Gaughan was a Johnny-come-lately, getting in at the heels of my hunk. She was watching TV when the news was announced, and when she heard the words, "One of the IRA prisoners on hunger strike has died," her stomach seized and she wondered if it was Hugh Feeney or Jerry Kelly. The authorities would claim that Gaughan had died of pneumonia, but his family suspected that his death had been precipitated by complications associated with force feeding, a scenario that was hardly difficult to imagine. Roy Jenkins was starting to have what he later described as forebodings of menace. He had been thinking lately of Terence McSwinney and the huge wave of recrimination to which his death had given rise. What kind of reaction might ensue if the Price sisters died? Jenkins was loath to give the impression that he would make any decision under duress. But privately, he began to fear that if Dolores and Marion succeeded, he himself could be a target for the rest of his life. This wouldn't just mean that he would have to forego holidays in South Armagh. The Irish were everywhere. Nowhere would be safe. If those damned girls delivered on their intention, he worried, I might never again be able to walk in freedom and security down a street in Boston or New York or Chicago. Reluctantly, Jenkins decided that he had no choice but to capitulate. On the 8th of June, Dolores, Marion, Jerry Kelly and Hugh Feeney released the statement. We went on hunger strike 206 days ago in support of our demand for political prisoner status and transfer to prison in Northern Ireland, they wrote. Roy Jenkins had assured them that they would be returned to Northern Ireland, they continued. So they had decided to terminate the strike. Ours was never a suicide mission, they maintained, since we did not set out to kill ourselves, but only to secure just and indeed minimal demands. The transfer was not immediate. Instead of being shipped back to Ireland, Dolores and Marion were relocated to a women's wing of Durham Prison. But one day in March 1975, at lunchtime, all the prisoners at Durham were ordered into their cells. Something in Dolores's heart told her that this might be the day. She went to her cell and started packing. She put on her coat, gathering her few belongings. Then the governor walked in and announced that they were going home. Or, not home. You're going to Armagh. That's near enough for me, she said. Marion ran into her cell and they hugged each other so tightly that they could hardly breathe. They shoveled the last of their belongings into bags and the screws rushed them out into the hall. Dolores was so drunk with excitement that she hugged the prison governor. The sisters were taken to an Air Force base. The flight took off and England receded into the distance. On board the plane, a man in uniform made coffee. They had been flying over water for some time when Dolores looked out the window and suddenly glimpsed green land below. She burst into tears. That's not Ireland yet, Marion said. That's the Isle of Man. They flew some more. Then Dolores looked out and saw green in the distance again. Is that it, Marion? She asked. I think that's it, Marion said. As the Price sisters disembarked, British Army photographers took their picture, the flash bulbs lighting up the early evening sky. The two women were overjoyed to be home, but distressed about the timing of their arrival. In February, Bridie Dolan, their aunt, had died. As a minor Republican icon, she was treated to a big funeral. The authorities sent photographers to snap surveillance shots of the mourners. 4 days after the funeral, Chrissy Price died of pancreatic cancer. Until very recently, it had looked as though the mother would outlive her daughters, not the other way round, and Dolores and Marion were distraught. They petitioned for compassionate leave to attend Chrissy's funeral, but the request was denied. Instead, they sent a wreath of Easter lilies. 400 people joined the slow-moving cortege from Slievgallion Drive to Milltown Cemetery. Albert walked alongside the coffin, his head bowed. The whole solemn procession was led by a young girl playing bagpipes. She wore the black beret and dark glasses of the IRA. 15. Captives. For weeks after their mother disappeared, the McConville children clung together, trying to hold on to the family home. They had to be there in the event that Jean returned. But eventually, the social welfare authorities intervened and two cars arrived at Devis Flats to take the children into care. Helen McConville loaded her younger siblings into the vehicles, promising that they were going away only till Mummy comes back. As the children piled into the seats, Helen looked up and saw their neighbours from Dillis gathered on the concrete balconies, watching silently. "Fuck yous all," she muttered. Then they drove away. The oldest child, Anne, was still in the hospital. Robert was still interned. Archie was old enough to work and take care of himself, and Agnes remained with Granny McConville. But Helen, Michael, Tucker, Susan, Billy and Jim were brought to South Belfast and up a long, curving drive to an imposing four-story red brick orphanage called Nazareth Lodge. It proved to be a wretched environment. Many of the children living there had been wards of the state since infancy and seemed numbly accustomed to institutional living. But the McConville kids had grown up in a home. They were haunted by their mother's disappearance and by their father's death before that, and they had now been living wild for several months. The orphanage was run by an order of stern nuns who were legendary for their sadism. One former resident described the facility as something out of Dickens, a bleak, pinched place where beatings and harsh punishment were routine. It was around this time that Michael McConville became a master of escape. From the moment he was removed from the flat at Divis, he would contrive ways to sneak out and run back to West Belfast. He was a restive, streetwise child, a child of the Troubles, and he was angry. At one point, when he was dealing with a welfare authority, an official suggested that his mother had abandoned the children. "That's lies," Michael shouted. In March 1973, the same month that Dolores Price was bombing London, Michael and Tucker were summoned to court in Belfast on a shoplifting charge, and the decision was made to move them out of Nazareth Lodge, out of Belfast altogether. In fact, to the De La Salle boys' home, 22 miles away in County Down, near the village of Kirkcaldy. The drive to the new home did not take long, but as far as Michael was concerned, it could have been 100 miles. The institution occupied a converted Victorian mansion nestled in the deep green countryside, as well as a series of newer cottages where the children were housed. The property was vast, 250 acres, and it felt wide and wild and open after a lifetime spent in the brick and concrete confines of Belfast. The grounds included a school, a swimming pool, tennis courts and a football pitch. They even had a billiard table. Kirkcaldy was, in the words of one person who resided there in those years, a pure nightmare. A subsequent government investigation revealed that a culture of physical force had pervaded the establishment, and both monks and lay employees would resort to violence on the merest of pretexts. Children were pummeled with fists, strapped with belts, and lashed across the knuckles with a thin wooden cane that snapped down with such ferocity it felt as if it might sever their fingertips. For all his grit and savvy, Michael was still just 11 years old. Tucker was 9. There were older children there, in whom this culture of abuse had already been well ingrained. They bullied the McConville boys without mercy. The Christian Brothers who ran the orphanage purchased clothing for their charges in bulk. So the children walked around in garments that did not fit, shirt sleeves that rolled up past the elbow, capacious adult trousers that needed to be held up with a belt, urchin ensembles that compounded the sense that this was a storybook purgatory for Belfast's misbegotten. The adults at Kirkcaldy put the children to work. Sometimes the staff would hire them out to the neighbouring farms as labour to pick potatoes. In the evenings, as everyone watched a programme in the darkened TV room, monks in their long robes would instruct certain children to come and sit on their laps. Sexual abuse was rampant at the home. Michael was never molested himself, but at night he would watch from under the covers as shadowy adults entered the dormitory with a torch and plucked sleeping boys from their beds. Michael and Tucker ran away. They felt a duty to get back to Belfast in the event that their mother reappeared. But each time the boys ran off, they were returned, and each time they came back, they were beaten. The McConville boys ran away so frequently that eventually the staff at Kirkcaldy took their shoes away, on the theory that even if they managed to get off the grounds and as far as the country road, where they might thumb a ride back to Belfast, it would slow them down if they were barefoot. The authorities may simply not have realised at the time the kind of predatory behaviour that was happening inside the walls of Kirkcaldy. But if they did get any inkling of the environment at the home, it did not stop them from sending other children there. Eventually, the twins, Billy and Jim, were reassigned from Nazareth Lodge to Kirkcaldy. As the car made its way from Belfast down the coast of Strangford Lough in the direction of the orphanage, the boys sat in the back, consumed by apprehension. They were 7 years old. They became the youngest children at Kirkcaldy, and it was as if they had been fed to the wolves. They were physically assaulted by the older kids, and Billy was sexually abused by the grown-ups. The boys could not turn to any of the adults for help, because so many of the staff were molesting children that the behaviour was silently tolerated. All the Christian brothers, one former resident explained, were in it together. Some of the McConville children were so scarred by their experiences in the Catholic institutions of Northern Ireland that they developed a fear of priests in general. Even as adults, the mere sight of a man of the cloth could fill them with anxiety. The De La Salle brothers later admitted that widespread sexual abuse took place at Kirkcaldy during this period. The Sisters of Nazareth, who administered Nazareth Lodge, have also acknowledged a pattern of physical abuse at that home. Helen McConville was too old to be kept in care against her will, but still too young to be a legal guardian to her siblings, so she struck out on her own, staying with Archie or with friends. She found work at a company that made funeral shrouds, and as a waitress. During her stay at Nazareth, she had briefly met a boy her age named Seamus McKendry, who was working as an apprentice carpenter at the orphanage. After that initial encounter, they fell out of touch, but 2 years later, when Helen was waitressing, they crossed paths again and fell in love. They married when she was 18. There were times when it seemed that there was no home that could hold Michael McConville. Eventually, after escaping on one too many occasions, he was moved once again, sent this time to a training school not far from the town of Newton Ards. Known as Lisnevin, this school had recently been established, in spite of protests from the surrounding community, as a secure residential facility for boys. Even calling the place a school was a bit of a euphemism. Lisnevin was a juvenile detention facility for kids who were too rough or too willful for places like Kirkcaldy. Michael's new housemates included serial escapees like him, along with a rogues gallery of misfit adolescents who had been arrested for burglary, assault, and paramilitary activity. The main building was a converted mansion, the centrepiece of some once grand country seat. It now featured isolation rooms, cells stripped of furniture, with bars on the windows, in which errant children could be locked in solitary confinement. The property was surrounded by a tall perimeter fence, which was electrified and equipped with an alarm that would sound if anyone should try to escape. Lisnevin might have seemed like a gulag, but Michael loved it. He would later joke wryly that Lisnevin was the best home he ever had. The staff liked to say that the fences were for keeping people out, not keeping people in, and it may be that by sealing out some of the tragedy and mania of the Troubles, Lisnevin created a space in which a victim like Michael McConville could finally settle down and begin to heal. The facility was non-denominational, and there were regular sectarian skirmishes between Catholic and Protestant residents. But Michael steered clear of trouble. He got to know a kindly nun, Sister Frances, who looked out for him. She befriended his siblings as well, and for years afterwards, even after she moved away to America, she would send them cards every Christmas, with a dollar bill folded inside. It was a minor gesture, but to the motherless McConvilles, it meant the world. Michael was eligible for weekend leave, like a furlough from prison, so he would go back to visit Belfast, staying with Archie or Helen. When they were together, the children never spoke about what happened to their mother. It was too painful, but their sense of the family as a unit had begun to erode. Increasingly, they were each alone, fending for themselves in unforgiving territory. As soon as Michael turned 16, he left Lisnevin and set out in search of a job and a place to live, in search of a life. He had been living in institutions for nearly a third of his years, but this was how it worked. When you reached 16, they simply opened the door. They did very little to prepare you for this abrupt emancipation. Nobody taught you how to rent a flat or find a job or boil an egg. They simply let you go. When Brendan Hughes returned to Longcash after being apprehended in his guise as a toy salesman, Jerry Adams was still there, doing time. Adams had tried twice to escape, but he was not the tactician that Hughes was, and he had been caught and given a sentence for his efforts. Adams had settled into life in Longcash. Compared with life on the outside, on the run, sleeping in a different bed every night, fearing the knock on the door, never knowing if you might be recognised on the street or shot on sight, he found the predictable routine of prison life relaxing. The wire enclosures surrounding the Nissan huts where the prisoners lived were known as cages, and each had a number. Hughes and Adams shared cage 11. The two revolutionaries had been close before this stint in confinement, but now their bond grew tighter as they cohabited in the intimate confines of a cell. The hut was drafty and spartan, and chill winds whipped through the camp. In the winter, they wore socks over their hands, like gloves, to keep warm. They nurtured themselves on endless conversation. Adams, who had always had a scholarly bent, encouraged the men around him to harden their minds. The prisoners organized lectures and discussion sessions. They would meet at the wire, the fences separating the different enclosures, and discuss politics, history, and the latest news from the war outside. A fresh-faced, headstrong young IRA prisoner organized cultural classes. He wrote poetry and would become the official press officer for the Republican prisoners. His name was Bobby Sands. The place came to feel, Adams later remarked, like our barbed wire ivory tower. Adams was a witty, engaging interlocutor with a piercing mind. But for all his gregariousness, there were aspects of his personality that he kept to himself. Whereas Hughes had come to regard himself not just as unreligious, but anti-religious, Adams was quietly immersed in Catholicism. At night, Hughes read speeches by Fidel Castro. Adams recited the rosary. By the mid-1970s, Adams was confronting a dilemma. From the moment the provisionals emerged in 1969 and began to bring the fight directly to the Unionist establishment, there had been a sense that it might take just one final furious push to drive the British into the sea. It was this strategic thesis that accounted both for the frantic pace of operations during the early years of the Troubles and for the high morale that drove recruitment and galvanised the lads. As the conflict entered its sixth year, however, it appeared that matters might not be so simple. After years of violence, the brunt of which was often felt by the very citizenry the IRA claimed to represent, public support for the provos had tapered. The British, meanwhile, seemed to be settling in for a conflict of indefinite duration. When Adams and Hughes met their subordinates for conversations at the Wire, they could see a new set of installations being built at the prison, the so-called H-blocks, which, once they were completed, would have the capacity to house many more paramilitary detainees. Adams' father, Jerry Sr., had been an IRA man as well, and had taken part in a campaign during the 1940s that fitted squarely into the long Republican history of noble failure. When Adams was growing up, he would see veterans of earlier conflicts hanging out at the Felons Club, a social club that his father had helped to found, where men like Albert Price would drink and tell war stories and ruminate about what could have been. It was almost as if defeat suited them better than victory, in the words of one historian, for there was a sense in which Irish republicanism thrived on oppression and the isolated exclusivity that came with it. During the early 1970s, it had become commonplace for the provost to declare every January that this was the year they would eject the British once and for all. For people of Adams' generation, who had beheld the fall of Saigon, the sudden toppling of regimes seemed like something that was readily achievable. But after a few years and a great abundance of spilled blood, those January resolutions were beginning to seem delusional. To be sure, there was a doomed romance in the notion of Republican failure, a poetry in those archetypes of futility. But Jerry Adams was not a romantic. This time, he told his men, the struggle must come to something. This generation of Irish Republicans would not simply pass the baton to the next one. They must force change within their own lifetimes. Even as he made this case, however, Adams began to argue that it would be naive to expect immediate results. What the Republican movement should do instead was hunker down for what could come to be known as the Long War. Stop telling people victory is just a year away. Better to marshal your resources and plan for a fight that could take much longer. This was not an easy argument to make. The foot soldiers of the provost had been beaten by loyalists, shot by the army, and tortured by the police. They had abandoned their families to go on the run, and now they found themselves locked up alongside Adams and Hughes at Long Cache. They could readily embrace a message that said, if you just fight a little harder right now, this will all be over soon. But it was quite another thing to tell them, get used to this, because the fight won't end after our next big offensive. It could take years, even decades. Adams also began to subtly modulate the language in which he talked about what victory itself might mean. It was important to fight the long war, but also to recognise that the end of the conflict would probably result not merely from a military triumph, but from some variety of political settlement. The armed struggle is simply a means to an end, Adams would tell the young IRA men at the Wire. It is not the end itself. Yous are politicians, he told them. We're not really. We're army, they replied. No. You have to develop your consciousness in here, Adams insisted. Politics is important. Adams commanded respect and loyalty inside the walls of Long Cache, but he wanted to get his message to the volunteers fighting the war in Belfast and Derry. So, in 1975, he began writing a series of articles for Republican News, the movement's propaganda newspaper. Because it was illegal to be a member of the IRA, writing such articles under his own name might be risky, so Adams adopted a pseudonym, Brownie. After composing each fresh column, he would smuggle it out of the camp. Secret documents, or comms as they were known, regularly made their way in and out of Long Cache. These memos and letters would be etched in tiny handwriting on cigarette paper, then palmed to a visiting friend or spouse. In this manner, the IRA's command structure inside the prison remained in near constant contact with their counterparts on the outside. Republican News was edited by a baby-faced propagandist named Danny Morrison. Sometimes the briny columns were light-hearted, showcasing Adams's dry humour. Sometimes they were treacly, though his sentimentality tended to feel more calculated than sincere. Often, the articles served the purpose of educating people on the outside about the conditions in which the prisoners lived, but Adams also used the columns to wrestle with his own emerging philosophy of the conflict. He frequently handed drafts to Brendan Hughes for feedback before he sent them out to be published. But Hughes had never been quite so analytically inclined. Sometimes he had to read a column 3 times just to get the thrust of Adams's argument. In 1977, Adams was released. On his final day, he paced around the yard with Hughes, talking strategy. He had come to believe that Sinn Féin, the political entity associated with the IRA, needed to operate more in tandem with the armed organisation. He also thought that the provos had to be reconstructed. Traditionally, the IRA had imitated the hierarchical configuration of the British military, but Adams believed that the provos should reinvent themselves, adopting the type of cellular structure more typical of paramilitary organisations in Latin America. They would be more secure this way. If the authorities managed to interrogate and turn one gunman, he would know only the contacts of his particular cell, rather than the whole command. What Adams was proposing was an ambitious reorganisation. It was also the blueprint for an IRA that could fight the long war. On that final day at Long Cache, with his belongings in a brown paper bag, Adams gave Hughes a hug before he walked to the gate. He joked that of the two of them, Hughes had the more enviable job, staying behind to keep things under control in Long Cache. Adams may have been a free man now, but he would have the more daunting task of reinventing the IRA. The truth was that the job Hughes had would be anything but easy. Towards the end of 1975, internment had officially ended. From now on, rather than being detained indefinitely as political prisoners, paramilitary suspects would be charged like ordinary criminals. This might have seemed like mere semantics, a simple matter of classification, but the distinction cut to the core of the Republican identity. To call IRA volunteers criminals was to delegitimise the very basis upon which they had taken up arms. Even in the face of bombs and bloodshed, the government in London might stubbornly refuse to call the Troubles a war, but as far as the IRA was concerned, Hughes and his comrades were soldiers, and if captured, they should be held as prisoners of war. Internment had its own problems. You could be arrested without charge and confined without a trial for years. But people who were interned were generally permitted to wear their own clothes behind bars, and they could freely associate with their paramilitary colleagues. Now, with internment ending, anyone convicted of paramilitary activity was confined to an individual cell in the new facility at Long Cache, the H Blocks. The prison issued uniforms, and it didn't matter if you were an IRA volunteer or a common thief, you got the same uniform. In autumn 1976, the Republican prisoners rebelled, refusing to wear the clothes issued by the prison, and initiating a so-called blanket protest, in which prisoners wrapped themselves naked in blankets, just as the Price sisters had done following their arrest in London. One ditty that the protesters sang captured the stakes. "I'll wear no convict's uniform, nor meekly serve my time, that Britain might brand Ireland's fight 800 years of crime." What the protesters wanted was special category status, which would effectively classify them as prisoners of war, but the authorities refused to grant it. Inside Long Cache, relations between the inmates and the screws deteriorated, and a grinding game of mutual escalation took hold. The protesters refused to wear clothes, but initially they would leave their cells to shower and use the toilet. The guards, frustrated by their defiance, would sometimes subject them to beatings on these trips and restricted their use of towels to cover and dry themselves. So the protesters started refusing to leave their cells at all. The guards were obliged to go from cell to cell, gathering chamber pots to be emptied. But the prisoners started tipping the pots so that piss sluiced under the cell doors and out into the corridor. And so the blanket protest, which had become a no-wash protest, now blossomed into the dirty protest. A great tide of urine coursed through the prison, which the guards now had to clean. This left the issue of what the protesters should do with their shit. And when they raised this dilemma with Hughes, who was the commanding officer inside the prison, he made a suggestion. Daub it on the walls. Hughes and his men were naked and filthy, with wild beards and long, matted, unwashed hair, and now they began to paint the walls of the prison with their own solid waste, swirling it into Van Gogh moons and lunatic patterns. The place took on the aspect of a madhouse, as maggot infestation set in and the threat of disease began to assert itself. A team of screws would barge into the squalor-encrusted cells and haul the scrawny prisoners out, then hose the men down while another team attacked the filthy space with water and disinfectant. But even placing a protesting inmate in a fresh cell made little difference. A single metabolic cycle would furnish him with the tools to despoil it. A visiting priest surveying the prison compared the men to people living in sewer pipes in the slums of Calcutta. If, on the face of it, there was something comically grotesque about this whole ordeal, an avant-garde experiment in the theatre of the absurd, underlying it was something more familiar. Yet another game of brinksmanship. The demands of the prisoners were relatively simple. They wanted the right not to wear the prison uniform, to be able to associate freely with other prisoners, and to receive mail. But with each escalating gesture, they seemed only to harden the resolve of their adversaries. Who would yield first? Though Jerry Adams was no longer in prison, he remained in close contact with Hughes via smuggled comms. He succeeded in reorganizing the provost, shifting the center of gravity away from Dublin by creating a northern command. Adams was becoming increasingly vocal about his view that the long war could not be won unless the struggle had a political dimension. "We cannot build a republic on the IRA's military victories," he declared at one event in 1980. "We must realize, as have the imperialists, that victory through military means alone is impossible." Adams might be advocating for a political movement to run in parallel with the armed struggle, but he was not counselling any abandonment of violent means. In August 1979, Lord Louis Mountbatten, a cousin of Queen Elizabeth II who had served as the last Viceroy of India, was on his fishing boat in Donegal Bay off the coast of County Sligo when a radio-controlled bomb detonated, splintering the vessel to matchwood and killing him, along with two family members and a local boy from Enniskillen. In 1979, a new Prime Minister took up residence at 10 Downing Street in London. Margaret Thatcher was the leader of the Conservative Party, and she was already known for her fierce resolve. When she was a girl in the East Midlands of England during the Second World War, her hometown, Grantham, had been bombed by the Luftwaffe. Her closest advisor on Northern Ireland was Airy Neave, a hawkish aide who had served as her campaign manager. Neave had been a prisoner of war himself and had escaped from the infamous German prison camp at Colditz Castle. Influenced in part by her conversations with Neave, Thatcher came into office regarding Northern Ireland as somewhat akin to the Sudetenland. Those parts of Czechoslovakia that were predominantly ethnic German and that had been annexed by Hitler on the eve of the war. Like the Sudetenland Germans, the Catholics in Northern Ireland might have been the victims of an accident of geography, but in Thatcher's view, that did not give them the right to simply break off and join a neighbouring country. When she was briefed on the subtle demographic factors that fueled and perpetuated the Troubles, Thatcher would murmur, "So it's like the Sudetenland." If Thatcher seemed poised to be a hardliner on the Irish question, her position was only reaffirmed by something that happened shortly before she took office. On the 30th of March 1979, Airey Neave was driving his car out of an underground car park at the House of Commons when a bomb under the driver's seat exploded, killing him. The bomb was set not by the Provost, but by a different Republican group, the Irish National Liberation Army, which took credit for the attack. Shortly after learning the news, a stricken Thatcher, labouring to preserve her trademark calm, said that Neave had been one of freedom's warriors, courageous, staunch, and true. The murder, less than 2 months before she became Prime Minister, would set the stage for her staunchly uncompromising posture towards any form of Irish republicanism. By the time Thatcher began her new job, several hundred men were participating in the dirty protest at Long Cash. The willpower of the demonstrators was extraordinary. "You were going against your whole socialisation of how you were brought up," one of them later recalled. "Everything you ever learned about basic hygiene and manners." As if tensions with the Screws was not high enough, the Provost had started targeting and killing off-duty prison officers. But still, the British would not relent. When the Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Roy Mason, ended internment and special category status in 1976, he described the IRA prisoners as thugs and gangsters. Thatcher would sign the same note. "There is no such thing as political murder, political bombing, or political violence," she maintained. "We will not compromise on this. There will be no political status," in a crisp formulation that would soon become famous. She asserted, "Crime is crime is crime." In the autumn of 1980, Brendan Hughes answered with a further escalation. He announced plans for a hunger strike and asked for volunteers. Morale among the prisoners was such that 100 or more people came forward. A team of 7 was selected. They would be led by Hughes, who had decided to participate in the strike. He had always taken pride in not asking a subordinate to do anything he was not prepared to do himself. In the last week of October, the men began refusing food. For weeks, Hughes sat in his cell, growing weaker and more frail. His cheeks sunken, his ragged black beard and long hair giving him the look of an ancient soothsayer. The prison doctor was a man named David Ross. He was kind to Hughes. Each morning, Ross would come in and bring a flask of fresh spring water, explaining that it was better than the tap water in the prison. He would sit on the edge of the bed and talk to Hughes about fishing and about the mountains and the rivers and the streams. Brendan Hughes had made his reputation as a peerless tactician. But at the very outset of the strike, he had made one significant tactical mistake. Because all 7 men had embarked on the strike at the same time, eventually one of them would be the first to reach the brink of death and the other 6 would be forced to choose between calling off the strike and saving him, or pushing forward and letting him die. One of the younger strikers was a 26-year-old from Newry named Sean McKenna. Hughes had not wanted McKenna to take part in the strike, but McKenna had insisted. Once the fast began, he quickly grew ill and was eventually confined to a wheelchair in the hospital wing. As the strike progressed, McKenna grew more fearful, and at one point he said to Hughes, "Doc, don't let me die." Hughes promised McKenna that he wouldn't. Just before Christmas, McKenna started lapsing in and out of a coma. Hughes saw orderlies rushing him on a stretcher through the hospital wing. He saw 2 priests standing with Dr. Ross. If Hughes did not intervene, the boy would die, and he would have violated his promise, just as he had violated his promise of clemency to Seamus Wright and Kevin McKee. If Hughes did intervene, however, the strike would be over, The strikers would have blinked, squandering their leverage. Hughes could smell the festering bodies in the hospital ward. He was conscious of the smell of his own body eating itself. Finally, he shouted, "Feed him!" And like that, the strike was over. A doctor instructed the orderlies to prepare some scrambled eggs. As he started to eat again, after his 53-day fast, Hughes slowly recovered and regained weight. But he felt deeply ashamed about botching the strike. The prisoners decided, almost immediately, to mount a second strike. This time, they would stagger the strikers, so that one would begin, followed by another a week or so later, and then a third a week or so after that. This way, the decision of whether to continue would not be a collective one. It would be entirely up to each striker to decide whether or not to die. Because Hughes was still recovering, the prisoner selected a new leader for this second strike. He would be the first to start refusing food, and presumably, the first to die. They chose the young volunteer who had coordinated the arts program, Bobby Sands. 16. A Clockwork Doll. The pretty cathedral town of Armagh, about an hour's drive from Belfast, was built on seven hills, like Rome. The skyline was dominated by the towers of two cathedrals, and near them stood a Victorian stone prison for women. Prior to the Troubles, Armagh Jail had rarely housed more than a dozen or so women at any one time. Most of the inmates were locked up for charges of drunkenness, prostitution, or fraud. But during the 1970s, when Dolores and Marion Price arrived, the jail housed more than 100 women, many of whom had been involved in Republican activity. The decision to move the sisters to the women's prison had sparked some controversy because of the formidable danger that they were said to pose. One unionist politician likened this custody arrangement to keeping a python in a paper bag. When the Price sisters stepped into the walled facility, a group of IRA women had assembled, holding a homemade banner that read, "Welcome home, Dolores and Marion." As they walked deeper into the prison, they saw other women staring at them and darting, nervously, in and out of cells. "Is it them?" someone whispered. They were celebrities. "We had heard so much about these girls and I expected to see two skeletons," one of their fellow prisoners later recalled. Instead, she thought, they were like two film stars. The other women had made a point prior to their arrival of neatening up the place. The sisters were introduced to Elaine Hickey, the no-nonsense officer commanding of the IRA inside the prison. She was reputed to be so formidable that even the screws listened to her. But the guards at Armagh were more relaxed than any that Dolores Price had previously encountered. They would hang back, lounging on a windowsill, giving the prisoners plenty of space. One of the women fried up some potatoes. Dolores ate them with gusto. She hadn't tasted anything so good in years. This ready-built community proved decidedly more hospitable than Brixton. But it was also the case that after 2 years in confinement, and the exertions and publicity of their hunger strike, the Price sisters were ready to retreat, somewhat, from the posture of political activism. Age is a way of curbing one's appetite for frontline revolution, and they were growing older. But there was also a sense in which, having fought for a transfer back to Armagh, and having said from the start that they had made no apologies for the bombing mission and would happily serve their time, the sisters had won. In March 1975, they were granted special category status, which meant that they did not have to work in the prison's laundry and sewing rooms, as other inmates were required to do. They were allowed to wear their own clothes and stay in a newly constructed area that housed the special category prisoners. C Wing, as it was called, was relatively commodious. The space was set up like a suite in a hotel, with a TV room and an eat-in kitchen. The head screw, a woman with protruding teeth who the prisoners called Big Susie, was not as unsympathetic as the guards in England. Security was much less tight, and the women were not forced to stay in their cells for long stretches. During the days, Dolores would paint and write letters. She and Marion were also able to take correspondence courses. They made handicrafts, which could be sold on the outside to raise money for the cause. Dolores did leather work, but she didn't enjoy it. In a letter to Fenner Brockway, a veteran British member of the House of Lords who had been supportive of the sisters during their time in Brixton, she described a wallet she was making him for his 92nd birthday and joked that when she put it in the post, he should not be alarmed at the sight of a small parcel from Northern Ireland. It was not a bomb. At night, after lock-up, the women talked to one another from their separate cells. Someone would lead them in the rosary, in Irish. Sometimes people told ghost stories. To Dolores, Armagh Jail felt like a boarding school without the teachers. In one snapshot from this period, the sisters struck poses alongside a smiling cohort of fellow prisoners and managed somehow to look glamorous despite their surroundings. But if this new life was better than the old one, it was still life in prison, and it soon grew dull. One week stretched into the next, and Dolores began to fixate on the sky that she could see through the prison window, that little square of blue. Some of the women in Armagh had initiated their own dirty protest, but the Price sisters did not take part. They were beginning, in subtle ways, to draw back from the movement. Things started going a bit askew, and you started questioning things, Dolores said later. In February 1978, the IRA attacked the Le Mans House Hotel outside Belfast, while it was crowded with civilians. The bomb killed 12 people and severely burnt dozens more. Things like that happened, and you have to say, what is going on, Dolores recalled. Am I here because I want to burn people to death? Am I here because I want to incinerate people? When the IRA ordered Dolores not to associate with other Republican women who had chosen to abstain from the dirty protest, she resigned from the organization because she could not obey the order. She and Marion had achieved legendary status in the IRA for the sacrifices they had made. But from then on, Dolores would become, in her words, a freelance Republican. In letters to Fenner Brockway, Dolores indicated that she had begun to reconsider the efficacy of violence. Dolores, like her sister Marion, has become convinced that the violence of the IRA is all wrong, Brockway wrote to Humphrey Atkins, the latest Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. I have told Dolores, as I did Marion, that if they were released from prison on the grounds that they had repudiated their previous action, they would probably be shot by the IRA and are therefore safer in prison. But by that time, the Price sisters were grappling with an affliction that was more pressing and immediate than politics. We didn't ever have a normal relationship with food or eating, Dolores said later. The months of starvation and force feeding in England had irrevocably complicated their relationship with nourishment. During a hunger strike, Dolores pointed out, your body is telling you it wants food, and you're telling your body, no, you can't have food. We will not win this struggle if I give you food. So there you're setting up a very difficult mindset, which has to be rock solid, or you will eat food. Because, you know, that's what the body does. That's what we do. We eat food and then we live. After that experience of self-abnegation, Dolores continued, the force feeding only compounded the trauma because it further alienated us from the process of sustenance, the whole process of putting food into your body. As a result, she concluded, we both ended up with very, very, very distorted notions of the function of food, and we both found it very difficult to re-establish a proper relationship with the process of eating. There may have been some element of social contagion at play within the intimate confines of Armagh Jail. Several other women in the facility had recently succumbed to anorexia. The sisters were no longer on hunger strike, but now they too stopped eating. Marion's weight began to drop precipitously. A confidential government assessment eventually concluded that to leave her in prison would be to leave her to die for crimes through which no one was killed. On the 30th of April, 1980, Marion was released from jail and went voluntarily under an assumed name to the Royal Victoria Hospital in Belfast. A government spokesman said that she had been receiving intensive medical treatment for the past 3 years, but that she could no longer be treated in Armagh. On the 1st of May, she checked out of the hospital. The news sparked an outcry. English tabloids implied that she had engineered a velvet prison break, that anorexia was simply the latest clever ruse by the IRA. Dolores was elated to see her sister walk free. Marion had been close to death, and now she would live. But deep down, she felt conflicted. All along, a little part of me had always hoped and thought that because we'd been through everything together, that again, this would be a together thing, she reflected later. The sisters had always been lumped together, as Albert's daughters, as student protesters, as members of the unknowns, and as prisoners and hunger strikers. Now, for the first time, they were uncoupled. To Dolores, it felt like I'd been separated from my Siamese twin. Like Brendan Hughes, Bobby Sands had grown up Catholic in a Protestant neighbourhood, but when Sands was 7 years old, his neighbour discovered that he and his family were Catholics, and they were ejected from their home. Eventually, Sands had joined the IRA. On the 1st of March, 1981, he stopped eating. His last morsel was a prison ration orange. It tasted bitter. I am standing on the threshold of another trembling world, Sands wrote on a scrap of toilet paper as he commenced his strike. May God have mercy on my soul. 2 weeks later, a second protester initiated a strike, and 1 week after that, a third, until eventually there were 10 men on hunger strike at Long Cache. There was no reason to think that Margaret Thatcher would be any more sympathetic this time around than she was during the previous strike. Faced with the failure of their discredited cause, the men of violence have chosen in recent months to play what might be their last card, Thatcher said. But 4 days after Sands commenced his strike, a politician named Frank Maguire died, triggering a dramatic chain of events. Maguire was a nationalist who held a seat in the British House of Commons, representing Fermanagh and South Tyrone. His sudden death would necessitate a by-election. Initially, Maguire's brother considered running to take over his seat, but he was approached by some Republicans who urged him to reconsider. An improbable but possibly ingenious plan was being hatched. Bobby Sands would run for the seat from behind bars. This would be a publicity stunt, to be sure, but a resonant one. What better way to garner attention and support for a hunger strike than to have one of the strikers run for office? If Sands were to win, it would dramatically upend the power dynamics of the strike. The British government might allow some unkept blanket man to die in prison. But what about a member of parliament? This gambit marked a radical departure for the Provost. There had been moments in history when Republicans ran candidates for elective office, but the movement had long been suspicious of the parliamentary process. For generations, many Republicans had adhered to a tradition of abstentionism, staying out of the politics altogether. There was a sense that one's revolutionary fervour could be diluted all too easily by the system. This had been part of the basis for the split in 1969 between the official IRA and the Provisionals, a sense that the officials had become too political and that politics would inevitably lead to accommodation. It has been a tradition down the decades, at least in the North, for Republicans not to vote, Jerry Adams would say. But as he began to argue for greater political organization by the IRA and Sinn Féin, he saw, for the first time, the potential of a new mode of Republican politics. There will be a time, he vowed, when Sinn Féin will be a power in the land. To Adams, who had been thinking through ways in which the struggle could become more political, the Sands election represented an extraordinary opportunity. There were many people in Northern Ireland who might not support the violence of the IRA, but would happily vote a Republican hunger striker into elected office. Working with Danny Morrison, the editor of Republican News, Adams began to mould a new philosophy that on the surface seemed to embody a contradiction. Sinn Féin would run candidates for office while the IRA continued to bring a bloody war to the British. Morrison would eventually capture the strategy in a famous aphorism, asking at a Sinn Féin gathering, "Will anyone here object if, with a ballot paper in one hand and an Armalite in the other, we take power in Ireland?" On the 10th of April, 1981, Bobby Sands was elected to Parliament. He had not eaten for 41 days. But even then, his demands were not met. Sands's condition continued to deteriorate, and now Margaret Thatcher faced a crisis. On the 25th of April, she spoke with Humphrey Atkins, her Northern Ireland secretary. "Sands is clearly determined," Atkins told her. "He's only got a few days," Thatcher said. "They are talking of two or three," he said. "But to be honest with you, Margaret, they really don't know." "No?" Thatcher said, with tart annoyance. "Because it's not a position with which anyone has very much experience." Atkins noted that because the strikers were staggered, even if Sands died and they could weather the backlash and bad publicity, the next striker was likely to die a few weeks later. "One hopes very much that we can prevent the thing going on week after week," he said. "I think there is bound to be a weak link." Thatcher speculated that the IRA leadership might not allow the strike to continue. If one died, and then a second one died, and then a third one died, and nothing happened. "It doesn't look very attractive," Atkins said. "No," Thatcher agreed. "It doesn't." Dolores Price followed the news of the hunger strike closely, but since Marion had left Armagh, she had started, gradually, to unravel. "I was lost without Marion," she recalled. Her weight was dropping rapidly, and she seemed increasingly isolated and unstable. At one point in May 1980, she swallowed a dozen sleeping pills. Whether this was a bona fide effort at suicide or a cry for help was not clear, but her stomach was pumped in the prison hospital. "I move as a clockwork doll," she wrote to Fenner Brockway, describing numb, empty days in which her only refuge was sleep. As her 30th birthday approached, she reflected that nearly all of her 20s had been wasted in prison. She thought about having a child and noted that this natural instinct might never be fulfilled. "It does hurt me deeply," she wrote, "and will scar the rest of my life." Marion Price had visited Dolores only a handful of times since her release. When she prepared to leave at the end of these visits, Dolores would cling to her, unable to let go. Having pledged years earlier to serve her time without complaint, provided she could do so in Northern Ireland, she was now feeling more indignant. "It is not fair," she wrote to Brockway. "I will have served 8 years in March. Even murderers don't serve that. I am doing life for causing an explosion." As a member of the Unknowns, Price had been involved in other operations that were genuinely deadly. But she hadn't been charged with those actions, and she did not mention them now. Instead, she pointed out that she no longer paid even lip service to the IRA, and that she had been made to feel an outcast, a traitor to their cause, because I have declared it to be no longer mine. Even so, she pledged her allegiance to the hunger strikers in Longkesh. I will be eating, as well as any anorexic can, but mentally I will live and starve each day with them, she wrote. Brockway was so moved by these letters that he made a direct appeal to Margaret Thatcher, arguing that the sisters had been caught up in adolescent emotion when they had perpetrated the bombing in London, and that they had assured him that they took part in the operation only on the condition that no human being would suffer. Brockway described himself as almost their spiritual advisor and said that both sisters had become convinced that violence is wrong. He assured Thatcher that if Dolores were released, she would dedicate herself, despite the dangers, to urging her fellow Catholics to refrain from violence. Thatcher was not so easily persuaded. I recognize that you are convinced that Dolores has renounced violence, she wrote, delicately suggesting that Brockway may have been a bit too ready to take the wily Price sisters at their word. Thatcher wrote that she had made inquiries about Dolores's current health, and that the doctors consider that she is a much tougher personality than her sister. One thing puzzled Thatcher. In the margin of one of Brockway's letters, she jotted, I am amazed that Marion goes to see her so rarely. That itself must be disturbing for a twin. It was indicative of the closeness of the Price sisters that Thatcher erroneously concluded that they were twins. But even so, Thatcher pointed out that Dolores seemed to harbour Republican sympathies, and should she be released, I doubt whether her old friends will let her alone. As Bobby Sands stood for election, Dolores Price was declining rapidly. The writer, Tim Pat Coogan, who visited her in C Wing at Armagh, was struck by her intelligence, but thought she had a lemur-like air. She counteracted the effects of the disease by dressing tastefully and attending carefully to her hair and manicure, Coogan noted, but she had grown too exhausted for most activity. On the 3rd of April, 1981, an Irish cardinal, Thomas O'Fee, wrote to Thatcher that he had visited Price and that she had been confined, for the past month, to the infirmary. Listless and companionless, scarcely able to walk and requiring help on the stairs. The cardinal had visited Dolores before, prior to her deterioration, and he remembered her as a vivacious character. What she had become, he noted, was a gaunt spectre, prematurely aged and deprived of any further desire to live. He asked Thatcher to recognize the stark fact that this girl is dying, and pointed out that, were she to die, it could precipitate an explosion of recriminatory violence. The cardinal begged Thatcher to release Price, saying that even next week may be too late. Still, Thatcher would not relent. She wrote back to O'Fee, saying that she understood the anxiety of the Price family, but that she had no intention of releasing Dolores. Miss Price's condition will continue to be very closely watched, she said. In mid-April, Price was rushed from Armagh to the secure ward in Musgrave Park Hospital in Belfast. By the time she was admitted, she weighed 76 pounds. Outside the hospital, Northern Ireland was once again engulfed in rioting. Street fights were raging in Belfast and Derry. Every day, people in the hospital would say that Bobby Sands would be there soon, and it seemed, for a time, as though Price would be joined in the secure wing by the young hunger striker with whom she felt such an affinity. Even in her wan state, this was something to look forward to. She hoped that she would be able to offer Sands one final salute. He never came. On the 5th of May, 1981, Bobby Sands died. It was the 66th day of his strike, and just as Terence McSwinney's death had 6 decades earlier, the story made headlines around the world. Jerry Adams later recalled Sands' death as having a greater international impact than any other event in Ireland in my lifetime. 100,000 people poured onto the streets of Belfast to watch his coffin being carried to the cemetery. There was an overwhelming upsurge of support for the Republican cause on both sides of the border in Ireland. Thatcher showed no remorse over taking a firm line. Mr. Sands was a convicted criminal, she declared after his death. He chose to take his own life. It was a choice his organization did not allow to many of its victims. But while the world focused on her fatal contest of wills with Bobby Sands, Thatcher had quietly shown that she was capable of mercy when it came to Dolores Price. 2 weeks before Sands died, Price had been released on medical grounds, and the balance of her 20-year sentence had been remitted. The official explanation for this decision was that she was in imminent danger of sudden collapse and death. For years afterwards, Price would weep when she thought of that moment in which Bobby Sands perished and she was set free. The Price sisters had stared down the British crown on two occasions, and in both instances, the damage they inflicted upon their own bodies was enough to make them prevail. Sands may have been less fortunate in that he perished, but he was more fortunate in the sense that he achieved more in martyrdom than he ever might have had he lived. And Humphrey Atkins and Thatcher had been wrong when they speculated that among the 10 strikers there must be at least one weak link. After Sands died, another 9 followed, starving to death one by one throughout that summer. But the link that Dolores Price felt to Bobby Sands ran deeper still. We were force-fed for a long time. It meant we did not die, she wrote years later. Once the British Medical Council refused to force-feed prisoners, then the British Parliament rushed a bill through, making it impossible to keep prisoners by shoving a tube down their throats. Not long after the Price sisters concluded their strike, the World Medical Association had issued a landmark declaration finding that force-feeding was unethical. With the determination made to stop force-feeding Dolores and Marion, the policy had indeed changed in the United Kingdom when Roy Jenkins announced that hunger strikers would no longer be subjected to force-feeding in British prisons. By triumphing in the particular manner that she had back in 1974, Dolores Price had unwittingly given rise to the circumstances that would allow 10 hunger strikers to starve to death 7 years later. In subsequent years, she would wonder if this did not make her in some way responsible. 17. Field Day. When the news that Dolores Price had been released became public, it prompted an angry outcry. Ian Paisley, the fanatical loyalist reverend and politician, described the suspension of her sentence as an outrageous scandal, arguing that Price continued to pose a very real threat to society because she had murder in her heart.